Today's Teisho will be on Case 5 in the Heikigan Roku in the Blue Rock Collection, the P.N. Lu. Case 5 is entitled Seppo's A Grain of Rice. Engo's Introduction. To guard and maintain the essential teachings of Buddhism must be the vocation of the noble person. He does not blink when killing a man, and then the man may be instantly enlightened. Hence he observes and acts simultaneously, and holds fast and lets go without restraint. He sees the essence and phenomenon are not two, that experience and reality run parallel. He often rejects the first principle and adopts the second. This is because to cut through the complications too abruptly causes the beginner to lose his footing. A day like yesterday, that could not be avoided. Again, a day like today, his transgressions fill the heavens. If you are clear-sighted, however, you cannot blame him. If otherwise you put yourself in the tiger's mouth, you will lose your life instantly. Now see the following. Main subject. Seppo addressed the assembly and said, "All the great world, if I pick it up with my fingertips, is found to be like a grain of rice. I throw it in front of your face, but you do not see it. Beat the drum, telling the monks to come out to work and search for it." Secho's verse. The ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. No dust on the mirror of the patriarch Soke. You beat the drum and search for it in vain. For whom do the spring flowers bloom? A number of people, I believe, are here for the first time on a Saturday and may never have heard a Teisho before. A Teisho is a special kind of talk. It's rather different from, say, sermon, and it's rather different from a lecture. Sermons are often intended to be like lessons for life. So a sermon is basically telling you what to do, generally speaking, giving you examples from, say, scripture, and saying, here's what you should do, and here's what you shouldn't do, here are the rules, don't break the rules, and so on and so on. Koan is a little different than that because it really doesn't give you the rules. Koan takes the rules away. You know? Koan says, this looks like a rule, but it's not a very good rule. And that looks like a rule, but it's not a rule. So where's the rule? And it leaves it for you to answer the question. A lecture is a little different also because a lecture is also giving you information that you should remember. So when I lecture in English, I say things and my students write them down in their books. And later they forget everything I said. But ideally, they're supposed to remember that. And probably at the end of the semester they throw their notebooks away, but in theory, anyway, the information I present is supposed to be worth holding on to. But a koan doesn't work like a Teisho doesn't work like a lecture either. Please don't hold on to what I'm going to say. Please don't hold on to it. Just sit on the cushion, watch your breath, and let all of this sort of wash over you. The function of a Teisho is to sort of wash over you like the sound of waves or like wind. And When you listen to the Teisho, you don't have to pay really like close attention. It's a little different from lecture, and it's a little different from say a sermon or something like that. You really aren't going to listen, or you really aren't going to understand the Teisho using the part of your mind that assesses and evaluates. So the Teisho is like if you heard the Teisho just now and you were listening carefully, you might have been baffled by it, right? I mean, so much of it is hard to understand. It says here that he does not blink when killing a man, right? Apparently the noble person doesn't blink when killing a man, and then the man killed may be instantly enlightened. That doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, first of all, we all know that Buddhism teaches nonviolence. How could an enlightened person kill somebody? And then how could somebody who's killed become instantly enlightened? So to the discriminating mind or the ordinary mind, this language is baffling, and it's a lot like poetry, right? I mean, the language of Teisho, the language of the koans in the Mumonkan and the Pienlu, that language is like the language of dream or the language of poetry. I don't know if you've ever had, if you've ever wakened up and still sort of remembered your mental processing while you were dreaming. But sometimes if you can remember it, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, you know. You might wake up and you might realize that you're worried about the paper. You know, you might wake up and maybe you were restless on the bed and you were worried about the paper. I've got to get the paper. And then you wake up and you think, what paper? You know, why was I worried? You know, there's an unconscious mind that does a lot of processing that the conscious mind doesn't necessarily see. And poetry often speaks to that deeper mind. And so this is the case also for the language of the koans. So when I just read that, those lines just now, they might not have made any sense to your evaluating rational mind. And you shouldn't worry about that. You know, the function of the koan is to sink into your deeper mind. And it sort of penetrates the way poetry penetrates or the way art penetrates. It does a lot of work on an unconscious level. I'm going to say things today that will make, I hope, some sense, you know. But all the same, when you're listening, try to listen with the kind of a mind that's focused still on your breathing, that's focused on the moment, and the things I have to say are really sort of secondary. You know, just let them flow by and don't worry too much about what I'm going to say. These koans are all used for the purposes of meditation. So when a student has finished with the mu koan in a preliminary way, the teacher will give the student one of the koans from these koan collections. And they have the character of being little stories that have some kind of a hook or some kind of a contradiction. And beginners often imagine that they can resolve the contradiction by thinking it through. But people who have had more practice understand that the thing to do with a koan is to sit down on the cushion, straighten your back, watch your breath, and repeat the turning phrase. And gradually, the koan sort of sinks into your unconscious and begins to produce a kind of transformation, which you won't become aware of until very late in the process. Once you're working with a koan, you may not know that you're processing it. You know, so once a teacher gives you a koan, You may think, well, Sesshin is over, I'm doing my job, I'm coming to sit in the evening, and I'm not really working with the koan. But please don't be deceived. The what we call in Zen the big mind, the unconscious mind, is sort of chewing on this koan all the time, day after day, week after week. And so this processing is quite sophisticated. At any rate, much of what I read may not make sense, but please don't worry. Part of Zen training is learning how to tap the deeper part of your mind, the unconscious part of your mind, and to tap into that extraordinary intelligence, which we modern people don't always take advantage of. So let me read once again the main subject. Seppo addressed the assembly and he said, "All the great world, if I pick it up with my fingertips, is found to be like a grain of rice. I throw it in front of your face, but you do not see it. Beat the drum, telling the monks to come out to work and search for it." So Seppo is a famous Zen master, and he is speaking to an assembly of students. And he says, all the great world, if I pick it up with my fingertips, is found to be like a grain of rice. I throw it in front of your face, but you do not see it. See? Now, you know, I think that's a, if you take that, if you read that as poetry, you know, as a kind of poetry, I think it's not so hard to understand what Seppo is saying. You know, it's very often the case that we go through our lives we go to our jobs and we come home, and on the weekends we might go to the beach or we might have a vacation in Hawaii or something like that. But at certain moments we feel that life is not really, that we're really not connecting with the world in a deep way. It's as though we're spectators, and life, or people in an audience, like at a movie theater, right? And life is unfolding, but somehow we're not really getting in contact with it, you know? It's an interesting interesting experience that I think we've all had. You know, it's possible to go to a place like Hawaii and to have a wonderful time, obviously. I mean, millions of people go to Hawaii every year and they have a wonderful time. But it's also possible to go to Hawaii and feel just as lonely or just as disconnected as you did in New Jersey. And I find that interesting because, you know, that feeling of connection is really not a function of where we are. You know, I remember going to Hawaii about 4 years ago, and some of it was quite exciting. But there were moments where I felt like I was just going through the motions. You know, we went to a beach, and it was a nice beach, and I had a nice time. But at the end of the day, I didn't really feel alive. You know, didn't really feel alive. Later I came back here to New Jersey, and I remember just cutting grass in the backyard of my house. And it was really one of those very hot summer days in New Jersey. I think that, you know, it was like 100 degrees or something. And the breezes were blowing through the trees. It was like a hot wind, you know. And the leaves were swaying over my head. And the grass was even blowing a little bit, the dry grass. And I actually felt so excited, you know, so alive. So I think sometimes we have this experience of connectedness, you know, and at other times we feel that we're just going through the motions in life, you know. I have to confess that I sometimes go into my office and my job, and it's a little bit rote. It's a little bit routine, you know. I like my job, and I'm pretty motivated. You know, I work very hard, but sometimes I come in and it's just I'm just going through the motions, you know. And I might have 50 emails to answer, and a lot of them are like trivial or not interesting. You know, I just have to answer them. And it might take me all morning to answer my emails. And then I'll have a meeting in the afternoon. I go to the meeting and not much happens at the meeting. And then maybe I have to prepare something like a report. And I'm writing the report, and I've written a report like this for a number of years, you know. And then I go home and, you know, maybe it's a Thursday, and instead of coming here to sit, I go home, and at the end of the day, I might be a little bit tired. I might be a little bit, tired because I worked hard, but it's like nothing in my life really connected, you know. But then there are these moments, including moments where I'm sitting on the cushion, where I just feel tremendously excited. You know, every once in a while, I'll pick up something. Maybe a book, or I'll see something on the internet that's really fascinating, you know. And it's like my pulse picks up, I suddenly become very excited and happy, you know. I'm sure this has happened to you. It's like suddenly I'm not a spectator anymore. I'm not going through the motions. But I really begin to feel like more alive or more connected. The other day I was, I got up early and I meditated, and then I went for a walk. And it was very early in the morning, and I'm a tree fan. So I have all these books on different kinds of trees, and I'm interested in horticulture and things like that. And I was walking down the street, and somebody had planted two new trees in front of their house. And when I looked at the trees, I became really excited, you know. They are a kind of tree called a Chinese elm. And they're a beautiful tree. And somebody had actually, planted Chinese elms in front of her house. And this was, to me, this was like, winning the lottery. You know, it was so interesting. Now, you know, you might think this is boring, but if you're a tree person, if you like trees, you know, finding that somebody's planted Chinese elms is like exciting, you know. And I became very excited. I inspected the bark. You know, I mean, let's face it, I'm a nerd, you know. So for me, this was interesting, right, you know. And I looked at the tree, and it had the right bark, and I looked at the leaf, and an elm leaf has an asymmetrical bottom. So the top of the leaf is a little point, right? But at the bottom, it's asymmetrical. One side is lower than the other side. This is how you know you have an elm. And I looked and it was like, damn, it is an elm, right? You know? And I was excited, you know? And sometimes I'll be looking at like a magazine or something, and maybe it's an art magazine, and I'll turn the page, and then there's this artwork. And it's just like, you know, again, suddenly exciting, right? You know, some people get this feeling, maybe when they play sports. One of my coworkers, a woman named Darcy Joya, has gradually emerged as like a serious amateur tennis player. She started playing tennis, I guess, maybe 10 years ago. And I didn't pay much attention, you know. She started playing tennis, and now she's in all these tournaments, and she crushes her opponents. She's like a serious tennis player. And, you know, she'll tell me, yes, I just had another tournament, or we just won our league tournament, and I got first place, and And I guess she's a, she, I know other people who play her, and they say she's a monster, you know, she just crushes you, you know. But she loves tennis, you know. When she plays tennis, if you let her, she'll talk about tennis, obsessively, right? And she clearly loves it, you know. Okay, so, you know, you could say that there's these two different, modalities, right? You know, sometimes we're going through life and we feel like we're just going through the motions. It's like, I know I'm supposed to be here at 10 o'clock in the morning doing this, and you're shuffling the paper, or, you know, maybe you're a doctor and you're doing your rounds, you know. And you're just sort of going through the motions, and it's possible to spend a lot of your life like that, right? And, you know, and some people spend a lot of their lives in that condition, where you're just going through the motions, and you feel like you're a spectator at your own life. It's like things are unfolding, but you're strangely disconnected. And this is really like exhausting, this condition, you know. And I think many people feel this way. I know that when she was young, in my mother's home, my grandfather didn't believe that women should have an education. I mean, he thought they should go to high school, but he thought a college for women was a waste of time. And so my uncle, my mother's brother, went to college. But my mother didn't go to college, and my mother really wanted to be a lawyer. You know, she was fascinated by the law. She got a job as a legal secretary in the courthouse in Plattsburgh, New York, and she was so engaged by this. She worked her way up to be the court reporter, and she was an excellent court reporter. She started out as a legal secretary. She was, you know, got new skills, and she was just fascinated by the law. I remember as a little boy, there used to be a show many of you have never heard of. It was called Perry Mason. But Perry Mason was this genius lawyer who would just, like, he would just crush his opponents in the courtroom, like Darcy would crush people on the court. And Perry Mason, my mother would never miss Perry Mason. It was like, you know, she was working when Perry Mason was on, everybody had to be quiet, and she would sit there, and she smoked cigarettes, and she would smoke and watch this show intently, right? Well, the point is that my mother really wanted to be a lawyer, and it was her passion. And after she got married, she became a housewife. This was after World War II, and women were not really encouraged to have careers. And even though my mother was a very good mother, you know, she was a good mother, she wasn't a happy person. You know, she would get up in the morning and she'd have to, do the laundry, and she would have to, clean the house. And I think she really would have loved to have gotten up and put on a suit and had her briefcase and gone to a court, you know. She would have loved that. And so, you know, she felt sort of stuck. And I think my mother often felt like she was tired and exhausted because she wasn't doing what she really wanted to do in life. And she was conflicted because she loved her children and she wanted to be a good mother, but she didn't feel fulfilled. And I think my mother often felt like exhausted at the end of the day. Yeah, I remember my grandmother came to live with us for a while. My grandmother had raised seven children on a farm in upstate New York. And she could go through our whole apartment in Baltimore in a couple of hours and just clean it all up, make the beds, you know, get everything done. And it would take my mother all day to do that job because my mother's My mother's heart, we say, heart wasn't in it, you know? And I think lots of people go through that in life. They go through the motions. They go to their job, and it's just a job, and it doesn't really create you know, this feeling of being connected or being alive. There's that mode of life, right, where you're doing what you're supposed to do, you're in the right place at the right time, you're shuffling the right paper, or you're delivering the right, you know, freight or whatever, but you're strangely disconnected. Now, there's this other mode of life, you know, where you're connected and you feel alive. And maybe you've noticed there are there's like two different modes, right? There's the disconnected and there's the connected. Now, when people think of Zen, they think of Zen as being about relaxation, calmness, and very often people think it's about detachment, you know, detachment. So, you know, I've had people talk to me about Zen and they say, yes, Buddhism. Now, I don't like that. You know, that's all about detachment. And I say, no. But that's a common understanding. You know, when you come in to do meditation, you do have to sort of detach, right? You have to turn off the iPod. You know, if you're meditating at home, turn off the TV. You go into a room somewhere. You close the door. It has to be quiet. You sort of stop focusing on maybe what you're concerned about, and you watch your breath. And it is indeed true that, you know, if you watch the breath, after a while you begin to have this very profound relaxation response where, you know, you'll feel much better. And if you keep bringing your mind back to the breath, you begin to feel very centered, very calm, and many of the things that bothered you during the day will begin to recede, you know. So there might have been an issue that was troubling you during the day, and it seemed very urgent. And when you sit down on the cushion sometimes, if you're really sitting, if you're really practicing, those problems begin to recede, and you begin to realize, oh, they're not as important as I thought, you know. So there is a dimension to meditation practice, which is, you could say, detached, right? And we are trying to be calm. We're trying to be focused and calm. And this is very, very important, but, you know, Zen is not just about being calm, and it's not just about being a little bit detached. That's like one stage in a process. You know, Zen is really, I would say, about being more deeply connected with the world. And it's really really about a kind of energized life, living an energized life, living life in that second mode, right? The connected mode. You know, now it's not possible to be connected 100% of the time. Sometimes we have to go through the motions. Sometimes we're not in what the Chinese called in the Tao, right? We're not in harmony with the Tao. But sometimes we're in harmony with the Tao, and there's this wonderful energy. And really, Zen is not just about being calm and being detached. Those are very important. But that's not like the end of Zen practice. That's like the beginning of Zen practice. Zen practice is like Zen is a kind of education in how to lead a connected life, and it's about living life with that beautiful energy that sometimes arises when we're in the Tao, when we're in the Tao. Now, this is sometimes very difficult to achieve. Because as we grow up, you know, people have expectations about what we're supposed to do and who we're supposed to be. And we, especially as little children, we want to be approved of by those we respect, you know. I was just reading the other day something in the paper about doctors. And it was quite interesting to me because, you know, when I was in high school, I was actually very good in the sciences. I got, I hope you won't mind if I say this, I was, you know, I got like straight A's in the sciences in high school. And I was very good in math. My mother, her dream for me was that I would become a doctor. She was so, it ate away at her that when I went to college, I didn't go into pre-med. And she would just beg me, she would say, "Kurt, you know, if you become a doctor, you can write your own ticket." And I really didn't know what that meant, you know, write your own ticket, but I think it meant you will have a wonderful life, you know. And she'd say, "Oh, you've got to become a medical man," you know. From my mother, the doctor was like at the pinnacle of civilization, right, the doctor. But the other day I was reading in the paper that like a very large number of doctors, like 68% or something like that, are really not very happy with their lives, you know, with their professional lives, you know. And I thought, how did that happen? But I think what happened was that they were, you know, they were doing what they were supposed to do. You know, they were following the instructions that they were given by their mothers, you know. And their mothers had said to them, you know, "Wendell, be a medical man," right? And they did it. And now they're not happy, you know. So I'm so glad I disobeyed my mother, in other words. But the thing is, you know, you do grow up getting pressure to be a certain way. And it's very hard to resist that pressure. And it's easy to wind up in a way of life, finally, that doesn't have that aliveness, you know. You've done everything, but you've paid your dues, but you're not alive. You don't feel connected, you know. And this is quite common, I think, you know. After I read that article on sort of job dissatisfaction among doctors, I read a couple of the most extraordinary articles. One was in Salon, and you can check it out, but it's about a couple. They were a middle-class professional couple, and they had a couple kids, and their lives were very safe and happy, you know, but they were going through the motions, and there was a kind of a staleness about their lives, and their kids were I guess getting into trouble, or their kids were having a lot of problems, and they decided that they had this idea that they would take some time off and take a family bicycle trip, you know, like a vacation on a bicycle. And you know, it's one of those crazy ideas, right? And I guess they did sort of like a trial run, and they had it was great. You know, they got two bicycles. One was a bicycle that had three seats, and the other was a single bicycle. And so it was like dad and the two kids on the back of one bike, and then on the other bike was mom. And this was like they did this little trip, and they loved it, and they thought, why don't we do a bigger one? And so they thought, you know, and the plan got bigger and bigger, right? Well, it turns out they've been on the road for 2.5 years. Yeah. I mean, they weren't insane. They made plans. Apparently, you know, their jobs allowed them to, you know, take some time away. I guess they sold their house, you know. But they decided to go from, like, Canada to... you know, Patagonia, right? You can do it. You can take roads all the way from the north down to the end of South America, and that's what they're doing, right? And the woman is a journalist, right? And she has been she's apparently got a book contract, of course, you know. But she's written on this, on the experience, and she says, first of all, that she loves it. And she said her husband loves it. And she said the interesting thing was her kids are happy every day, right? I mean, it could be BS, but it's always interesting. Now look, they're not poverty stricken, right? They're not riding bicycles and begging. They have money for food. It's an adventure, right? And they don't want to spend the rest of their lives on the bicycle, but they're really trying to do this, you know, from Canada to Tierra del Fuego, to Ushuaia in South America, at the end of the earth, right? And the kids think of it as this incredible adventure that they're on. And she said, you know, they're meeting all kinds of people, and they're going to these amazing places, you know. And they're sleeping in a different place every night, and you know, and it's, of course, it's good exercise. You try different foods, and of course, when she started writing about this, actually she was attacked. You know, lots of people wrote in and said, "You are a really bad mother. You know, look at what you're doing to those kids. You should be in jail. They should be taken away from you by social services and things like that." But other people wrote in more sympathetically and said, "God, you know, I wish I had your courage. You know, what a wonderful adventure." And she's not, you know, she's very unpretentious and a very good writer, and she seems to be quite honest. And when I read this, I thought, you know, that is really great. She's really in the Tao. You know, this is something that's a little unusual. But, you know, her kids will, she could just be in the suburbs, right? She could be in the suburbs. She could be, you know, pursuing her work as a journalist. There's nothing wrong with that. She could be, you know, like on a city desk in Philadelphia or something like that, or New York. And her husband could be driving to work every day, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we can't all get on the road on our bicycle, you know, but somehow this works for them, and they feel intensely alive, you know, and at the end of their lives, they're going to remember this trip, I think, with like this incredible joy, right? They're going to go, "Oh my God, we went on our bicycles from, you know, Nova Scotia to Patagonia, you know, the two of us, you know, can you believe, or the four of us, you know. Can you believe it?" You know, and the kids, you know, they will remember all their lives that they and their parents went on this astonishing journey, you know, with very ordinary equipment, you know. And I'll bet they'll think happily of this all their lives, right? Till the moment they die, they'll remember this amazing adventure that they had with their parents, because their parents were willing to, be with that energy, you know, and trusting that energy. And I just thought, that is just an amazing story. And I'm sure there are people who disapprove and who even get angry, you know. But I just think that's the best education those kids can have. A few years ago, I was reading about Mongolia, and I'm very interested in Asia, and I sometimes Google, you know, I'll Google Thailand and see what's going on, and I Googled Mongolia, and it was saying that a fair number of educated people in Mongolia are going back to being nomads, right? And so they interviewed this woman who was college educated. I don't know, remember what her degree was in, but it was in something like chemistry or something, and she's a nomad. She's herding, I guess they herd what, I don't know what they herd, but anyway, herding something across the Gobi Desert, and she just said, "This is the greatest life, you know." She said, we sleep in a different place every night, you know, the sky overhead, you know, clean water, clean air, you know, we eat, I guess Mongolian people eat a lamb, so they're herding sheep, and they eat cheese, you know, and that's about it, you know, so, but they had, she said, it's a wonderful life, right? I just think that's so wonderful. That's so cool, right? You know, in the world, we don't really have, like, in the West, and in the modern world generally, you know, we think, we have a scientific mind, right? We have a scientific mind. And science really, I think, says, imagine the world as it exists without any people in it. See, that's what really science is all about. It says, let's think about the world as though there were no people. So when you talk about an event, you don't think about his perspective or her perspective or her perspective. You just think about an absolute perspective, right, in which an event happens, no matter who you are, it's the same event. See, that's science. The modern world is like scientific. It says, let's imagine things from the standpoint of nobody, nobody in particular, an absolute event. You know, that's a Western view. And the old Western view was, let's imagine everything as though God were controlling everything. See? But the Asian view that comes out of, Buddhism and Taoism, and I think that Taoism really influenced Buddhism in China, was, you know, Lao Tzu, you know, the great founder of Taoism, he said, let's think about the moments in our lives when we feel most alive. See, that's what he wanted to focus on, was when do we feel most alive? So Lao Tzu was trying to say, let's live for being alive. Yeah? Let's follow the path of being alive. So, you know, instead of doing things that make us feel dead, let's pay attention to when we feel alive and let's live in that way. So following the Tao means to be alive. You know, if you do this, no energy. You do this, and energy. So go with the Tao. That means go with the energy. That's what Lao Tzu was trying to say. I'm so sorry that I was reading something the other day about how in modern China Taoism is really very neglected. Nobody knows what it is. In mainland China, nobody pays any attention. They don't understand it. I just thought that was such a disaster, because Lao Tzu was so great. You know, he said, let's think about life this way. Some things make us feel dead, and some things make us feel alive and connected. Let's live for being alive and connected. Let's build our life around that. See? And Zen is right in that tradition. See, Zen is all about being with that energy, being more alive, you know? And so even though that couple on their bicycle probably don't do Zen, they probably don't have time for Zen, you know? You know, riding that bicycle is a kind of Zen. You know, you get on that bike and you drive, maybe they do 50 miles a day, I don't know. But you know, they're in the flow. Flow is really not the right word. You know, in Zen, you know, we say being true to your true nature. If flow means you're in the moment and you're going with the moment. But this is deeper than that. See, this is deeper. You know, sometimes, you know, when we really feel alive, we're acting from a deeper place in ourselves. It's not just being in the moment. We're acting from a deeper place in ourselves. You know, for me, seeing a Chinese elm on the street was as exciting as finding $100 bill, you know, really, or $1,000 bill. Well, $100 bill. But it was exciting, you know. For another person, it would just be a tree, you know. So that's okay. That's not there. But for me, you know, part of my true nature is like loving trees. You know, I really am a nature boy. You know, so I like that. You know, and finding a Chinese elm, it's like, oh my God. You know, Chinese elms are very exotic. They come from China. They're planted in temples. You know, oh my God. You know, right here in Plainfield, the tree. You know. So that's my, you know, everybody's a little different, but your true nature is like the deep unconscious part of yourself but when we're true to our true nature, we feel connected and alive. And when we're not true to our true nature, we feel dead and we're going through the motions. So you know, it's a big mistake to think that Buddhism is about tranquilization, you know, where you sit on the cushion, you get tranquil, you feel better, and that is important. You know, the relaxation experience is very important, but that's not what the Mahayana is all about. the Mahayana has this dynamic character of being with that energy. See, and you know, there are people who have tried to measure qi. You know, there are actually some Chinese scientists who have tried to, you know, they hook up meters and they try to find the qi, you know. But I don't think they'll be successful, because qi is not like energy in the material sense. It's a psychological energy, right? It's not like radioactivity, right? Qi is my connectedness with the world. And when I feel connected with the world, and my body is connected to me, you know, when body, heart, and mind all line up, and another way to put it is when body and mind are together and the door to the unconscious is opened, then there's this incredible release of energy, right? That's qi. So I don't think I might be wrong, but I don't think these scientists will ever find qi. I think that's a modern Western misunderstanding of what Lao Tzu was talking about. Qi is knowable only in the personal way, I think. Your Tao, when you're in harmony with the Tao, it's going to look rather different from the way I am when I'm in harmony with the Tao. My true nature doesn't tell me to do the same thing as your true nature. Somebody's true nature says be a doctor, and somebody's true nature says don't be a doctor. See, that's that, okay. So I think if we are true to our true nature, we may get into a lot of trouble, but we will be alive and we will be happy. I think that's true. I was reading this other story that was really quite extraordinary. In Los Angeles, there is a Chicano, a Mexican heritage museum, and it has fallen on hard times. It was created, I think, in the 1940s, and it's been very neglected. And the board of directors of this institution decided to try to spruce it up, and they asked this distinguished Mexican painter to come up and do some murals about Mexican life and Mexican American life in the museum. And he is a well-known Mexican painter. He's about my age. He's in his mid-50s, and he's got quite a good reputation. And they invited him to come up, and they said, "Listen, we don't have any money. We'll pay you $100 a week, but we want you to do a mural." And he's been at it for 8 years. Yeah, can you believe that? He sleeps in a room in the museum. And he says, "Sometimes I get up at 3 a.m. and I paint." I just think, if he were here, I would do bows to him. Really, because he's a deeply realized human being in the Buddhist sense. He may not be a Buddhist, but he's a deeply realized human being in the Mahayana, because he's true to his true nature. He's true to his true... His agent probably said, "What? Are you crazy? $100 a week? You know, you're at the top of your game. You should be selling paintings for, you know, $100,000 a painting, you know." But this is not about that for him, see? You know, he sleeps in this little room. He gets up every day and he paints from like 3 a.m. until he goes to bed at night. And he's been doing it day after day, year after year. He's almost done this main part. And he said, "Yeah, I'm almost done. I think I'm going to go to the movies, you know, or something, and take a shower." You know? It's an incredible story. And you know, it's possible that this is going to become like a landmark, that thousands and thousands of people are going to go see this thing. It's possible the museum will decline in 10 years again, but he's doing what his true nature told him to do. See, this is, you've probably heard of this idea of flow, you know, like athletes can be in the flow, you know, they're not self-conscious, they're dribbling the ball, they go up and go through the hoop. That's flow, but this is deeper than flow. This is his whole life is involved in this, right? This is like 8 years of his life. And you know, people, often we have a divided mind. It's divided, right? You know, your mom says be a doctor, you don't want to be a doctor, you go to medical school, you know, you're there and you don't want to be there. And this is like the zero energy condition, right? This is where we have no energy. We're there, but we don't want to be there. Now, sometimes this is inescapable, you know? And there's an art to being happy in that circumstance, right? So I've had a lot of jobs that were hard and not very interesting, and I know how to be happy under those circumstances. But sometimes we have the opportunity to live more deeply. And sometimes we don't take advantage of it because we're afraid or we have a divided mind. From the standpoint of the Mahayana and the standpoint of Zen, the divided mind is the worst situation, right? It's a big problem. So, you know, when you're here but you don't want to be here, that's a divided mind, you know. And it's quite common, you know. I mean, one of the things meditation is designed to do is to unify body and mind. So normally I'm sitting at my desk and somebody's talking to me, but there's a part of my mind that's in, you know, the temple in, you know, is up in my old temple in Washington State, right? And that's a divided mind. That's not healthy from the Zen standpoint. When we sit down on the cushion, you know, when we sit down on the cushion, you're watching the breath, and so the mind and the body become unified in a very simple way. By focusing the mind on the breath, we're unifying body and mind. So it's like your mind is floating up in the sky, but you sit down on the cushion, and all of a sudden, you're back on the cushion, see? And you're right here. And that's very good training. And that's like an elementary form of the unified mind in accord with the way. But when we live our lives, you know, we can still have a divided mind. I'm supposed to be here, but I want to be there. And you know, the ideal, and it's not always achievable, but the ideal is to be, to have the unified mind. So this guy who's painting these murals at the Mexican Cultural Center in Los Angeles, he has a unified mind. He gets up every, that's how he can work so hard, right? Because the inside and the outside match up, see? The unconscious and the conscious match up. See, so his unconscious is saying, paint, 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 paint. And he could be selling insurance, right? And that creates a problem. And sometimes when we have a divided mind, it can create like neurosis or depression, right? But his deep self, his true self, is saying paint, 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 and he's painting, right? So this is like the ideal situation. And this couple that are going down the highway, the Pan American Highway, you know, they're unconscious, their big mind is saying ride, 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 right? And they're riding, so it matches up, yeah. So it's not always possible to do this. Sometimes circumstances prevent it, but sometimes we prevent it because we don't trust our big mind, or we don't listen to our big mind, or we're afraid of listening to our big mind. So a lot of Zen practice is learning how to trust big mind. And when we have setbacks, we can distrust big mind again. You know, but little by little, if you're true to your true nature, you get healthier, and there can be setbacks. You know, you're following your true nature. You know, this guy could finish the museum and they could sell it, and somebody comes in and whitewashes his mural, right? And that would be very depressing, and that would hurt. You know, but nevertheless, he's done what his true nature said, and he might get depressed. When they whitewash his mural, but you know, if he gets back up off the ground and he dusts himself off, he should go find another mural right away, you know, because that's what his true nature is telling him to do. I'm going to wrap this up just one more minute. Well, a couple more minutes. When I was young, I was moving furniture for the Mayflower Moving Company. And I had the opportunity to move furniture at this, I was called out to this farmhouse, a farmhouse in rural Virginia. And we were supposed to help unpack crates full of paintings. And they were done by this artist who had stored them in New York City in these flats. They were beautiful, big oil paintings. Magnificent. Apparently, this guy was a member of the American Academy of the Arts. And he was a well-known painter in the 30s and 40s. And he was a realist painter who did these marvels. He lived in an ashram in India. He painted the hills, the Ghats. He painted China. You know, he was an incredibly good realist painter. And apparently, he was almost dead. When we came into his house, his bed was propped up on books so he could look out the window. And he was propped up on pillows. And he was white as snow. His hair was white, his skin was white. He looked like he was on his last legs. He couldn't even get out of bed. And his wife was supervising the unpacking of these paintings, and she was weeping because they had been stored in New York and they had been damaged by water. And many of the paintings were stuck together. It was like his life's work was ruined, yeah, except for the stuff in museums. And the thing was, he was so calm. I thought maybe he was an idiot. You know, I thought maybe his brain was gone. But he was quite intelligent, and he was very articulate. And his eyes were, like, really bright. And his wife was so unhappy. She was just crushed by all this, but he seemed very happy, you know. And, you know, when I was going by their bookcase, I noticed Tibetan Book of the Dead, Diamond Sutra, Bhagavad Gita, you know, and it turns out they had been in India at this ashram, and I thought, what is his secret? You know, what is this guy's secret? He's lived this whole life as a painter. His work is wrecked, and he seems very happy, you know. And it's because he did what he wanted to do. He was true to his true nature. Yeah, and so the consequences weren't so important, you know. When you're dead, you might be famous and you might not be famous, but it doesn't help, right? What really matters is how you live. And he was true to his true nature, and that, I think that's why he was so happy. So anyway, today we have, this is like a schoolhouse for being true to your true nature. We're all students in this school, you know. But when I sit on the cushion, I'm in the groove. My inside and outside are matched. You know, the matching halves are matched, and it's really wonderful. And that can happen on the cushion and off the cushion. It's what the Mahayana is all about. So thank you for coming today, and please come back.